Today is Monday, September 6th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Taliban announces the capture of Panjshir Valley.
Said that there is no resistance left in Panjshir and that now the Taliban are in control of all 34 provinces of Afghanistan.
Plus, camper vans provide COVID quarantine in Australia outback.
Well, Kenya has one of the highest rates of COVID-19 transmission in the Australian state of New South Wales.
Also, UN marks World Charity Day. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. The Taliban says they have taken complete control of Panjshir province, the last area in Afghanistan being held by resistance forces. The Islamist militant group spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid tweeted the claim on Monday. In a translated notice attached to the tweet, the spokesman said that, quote, Panjshir province completely fell to the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, unquote, and that, quote, there would be no discriminatory acts against, quote, the people of Panjshir. Pictures on social media also showed Taliban members standing in front of the gate of the Panjshir provincial governor's compound. There was no immediate word from Ahmad Massoud, the leader of the opposition group resisting Taliban forces. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gill.
We have been hearing from the Taliban sources and multiple sources over the last 2-3 days that they have actually captured Panjshir province and that whatever was happening in the meantime was a so-called clearing process to make sure that whatever armed resistance had left in the area, they should be eliminated. But at the same time, we saw that Ahmad Massoud and his spokespeople would come out and deny all those claims. But out of the blue yesterday, Ahmad Massoud on his group's Facebook page posted a statement in which he offered peace negotiations to the Taliban, provided the Taliban withdraw all their forces from Panjshir. So that statement was quite intriguing and suggested that maybe Massoud is under pressure now, because Taliban continuously said that the fighting was taking actually place inside the provincial capital. So then overnight, what happened that the Taliban were able to, according to them, overcome whatever the final resistance had been left there. And this morning in Kabul, there was a big press conference held by the Taliban chief spokesman, who categorically declared the victory for the Taliban in Panjshir and said that there is no resistance left in Panjshir and that now the Taliban are in control of all 34 provinces of Afghanistan.
Do we know the whereabouts and fate of Massoud, the leader of the insurgents?
The same question was asked from the Taliban spokesman at the press conference today, and his reply was that he also has seen reports of Massoud and his other partner, former Vice President Amrullah Saleh, that they both have fled Afghanistan. But then he went on and said that he did not have any confirmed information about their whereabouts. So we still don't know, but we just know that Ahmad Massoud has issued an audio statement to his supporters on his group's Facebook, where he was basically expressing condolences with the families of some of his key commanders who were killed during overnight fighting in Panjshir, and they also included a cousin of Massoud, an army commander, and also the main spokesman, Fahim Dashte, of his National Resistance Front. So at least we know that wherever he is located, Ahmad Massoud, he is alive, and that's why the message he has just released like a few minutes ago is meant to send a message to his followers that he is alive, but where he is actually located is still not known to anyone.
If Massoud is indeed out of Afghanistan, analysts say it's likely to have crossed the border into Pakistan.
Northern Afghanistan and Panjshir Valley, which is Massoud's stronghold, actually is located just close to the border with Tajikistan. And that's where he would likely end up. Because if you go back 25 years ago, Tajikistan served a key supply lifeline for Massoud's father, Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was under attack from the Taliban when they were in control of Afghanistan at that time. But he successfully defended Panjshir. So, but the reason that he was able to defend Panjshir at that time was there were all kinds of weapons being supplied to Massoud, Panjshir Valley from Tajikistan, Russia was also involved in that supplies. India was also playing a role in providing supplies to Ahmad Shah Massoud at that time. But this time, we know that all neighbors of Afghanistan have collectively agreed not to support any insurgency and rather work together to promote peace in Afghanistan. And that's why we see that people were expecting that there will be some kind of an armed resistance to the Taliban's rule. And actually, it did happen, but it was also widely predicted that any insurgency against the Taliban rule will not survive.
That's VOA's Ayaz Goh speaking with me from Islamabad. With the last U.S. service member gone, ending a 20-year war, Afghans women and girls are facing the reality that Taliban are back in control of their country. As VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sen reports, there are already signs that their rights are in danger.
For Afghan women, the U.S. departure marks a new era of uncertainty and fears of what lies ahead. The Taliban have promised women certain rights under the framework of Islam. However, basic rights like going to school or work could soon be taken away. In the western city of Herat, Afghan women staged a defiant protest, demanding the right to work and representation in the Taliban's new government. Lena Haidari is a government school teacher.
I want to say that I was forced to stay at home for the crime of being a student 20 years ago, and now, 20 years later, for the crime of being a teacher and a woman.
State Department spokesperson Ned Price had this to say.
What we will be looking to when it comes to the issues that you've raised, including the potential for any forms of assistance, will be the actions of any new Afghan government, especially vis-a-vis the areas we care profoundly about. That is safe passage, respect for the rights of the people of Afghanistan, including women and girls and minorities. A government that is inclusive.
U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen told a Washington Post forum this week that the Doha Agreement, negotiated between the Trump administration and the Taliban in 2020, provided no guarantees of an inclusive government or protections for the rights of women.
I raised concerns with former Secretary Pompeo, with Ambassador Khalilzad, that women were not represented at the table, despite the fact that we have legislation on the books signed by former President Trump that says in conflict areas, women should be at the negotiating table when we are negotiating the end to the dispute. And those messages fell on deaf ears. So now we are dealing with a situation where women and girls were not represented at the table, and there are no assurances for them going forward.
A former Afghan judge living in exile told that same forum what she is hearing from women activists still in Afghanistan.
They are depressed, they are helpless, they cannot help themselves, not only themselves, but also they become dependent. That's also a kind of a way of how they see themselves being independent women, and all of a sudden entering the situation where they have to be dependent to the male family members.
Many fear the Taliban will return to the brutal way they ruled the country from 1996 until the U.S. drove them out in 2001. For now, many Afghan women are left to stay and fight for their rights, with a fresh protest Friday in Kabul. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
In a chaotic effort, the U.S. managed to evacuate more than 124,000 civilians from Afghanistan, including 6,000 Americans, by August 30th. However, Nasiriya is one of the 100 to 200 Americans who remain trapped there. She asked that we only use her first name for her safety. She spoke exclusively with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, describing her ordeal.
There's been days where, you know, I think to myself, like, am I going to make it home? Am I going to end up living here? Am I going to end up dying here? What's going to happen?
25-year-old California native Nasriya came to the Afghan capital in June to visit family and marry her longtime boyfriend. She and her new husband fled to the airport after the Taliban took control, but they never made it in.
It was so hard to just get on a flight. There was a couple of days where we had to sleep on streets. People were literally stepping over people. That's how bad it was.
After her booked flight home was canceled amid the chaos, she reached out to the State Department for help.
They told us, go to a certain location, you will be picked up. And this is from the State Department. You will get picked up. Go there. And it was in the middle of the road across the airport. So we went there, waited an extra 12 to 13 hours with no food, no water, nothing.
She'd wave her passport.
They won't let us go. They're gassing us at their food camera.
But day and night, the Taliban kept blocking her.
I was got gun pointed to my head. Our troops were literally at the gate, just waiting for us to continue walking. And they had blocked us. And there was a time where, like, I went past them and I started walking as fast as I can. And they started shooting right by my leg and told me to come back or they would shoot me.
Oh, my God.
That's how it was. And I've never in my life have ever been experienced anything like this. It was like a movie scene. It was like coming. It was like literally a movie scene.
She says her husband, an Afghan national, even begged the Taliban to let her in the airport without him. But she refused to leave him.
I was not going to leave without my husband because I knew in my heart I was never going to, you know, step a foot back in Afghanistan once I go home. And I'm pregnant. And definitely my child is going to need a father. I'm going to need a husband by my side.
Now that the U.S. military is gone, Nasria says the Taliban are hunting Americans.
And apparently they're going door to door from now, trying to see, you know, if anybody has a blue passport.
The State Department has told her to stay put and they will find a way to get her out. But she gets more discouraged with each passing day.
I don't even think I'm going to be able to go home. I definitely lost some hope. If I was only 15 steps away from the airport and I was told people are going to come out of the airport to get me, so what hope am I supposed to have now?
Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
The United Nations marked International Day of Charity on September 5th to encourage and mobilize people, private organizations, and stakeholders all around the world to help others through volunteer and philanthropic activities. The date was chosen to commemorate the anniversary of the death of Mother Teresa of Calcutta, who received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1979, quote, for work undertaken in the struggle to overcome poverty and distress, which also constitute a threat to peace, unquote. The day also is used to draw attention to the growing needs of the poor in areas of conflict. For more, I spoke with VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir.
So this is an international day that the UN General Assembly designated in 2013, and it honors Mother Teresa, the well-known missionary and Catholic nun who later became a saint after her death. She spent much of her life working in India. She's actually Albanian born, but she spent much of her life working in India with orphans, with the poor, with lepers, marginalized people. So this day in her honor, it's intended to recognize the important work that charitable organizations do. And it's also a day that the UN is encouraging people to do charity, to educate people about the importance of volunteer work and charity as a means of honoring her and just as a means of honoring all charitable workers.
When the UN talks of charity, most times it's not governments, either individuals or organizations. Is the UN encouraging them and in what way?
So yeah, absolutely. The UN works with the private sector and the public sector and also with individuals. And the whole premise of the UN is built on volunteerism, humanitarianism. For instance, right now in Afghanistan, so many people are leaving the country, but the UN is staying. And that's what they do everywhere where there's a crisis. And so this is the sort of situation, this International Day of Charity. It's an opportunity to raise awareness about the importance of helping others through volunteer and charitable activities.
With much of the world in turmoil, wars and farming and great need in so many nations, especially talk of Afghanistan, you talk of Pakistan, you talk of Ethiopia, you talk of the Tigray region, and also Africa. Will this day be significant when you have those kind of countries and those kind of problems facing the UN and, of course, the entire world?
I don't think it will be significant in the sense that people are encouraged to donate money on that day, for instance, or something. It's not like a day where that would happen. But I think it's more a day about reflection and reflecting on what we can do for our fellow man and woman, no matter where they are in the world, and just how we can all be a little kinder and a little more generous with our time and with our skills and our talents. Volunteering isn't, giving to charity isn't always about just giving money. It's about volunteering, about giving your time and your experiences, your knowledge, and your compassion. So I think that if the UN can raise awareness about any of these aspects, then it's been a successful day. But I would say look for a social media campaign. You know, we're still in the middle of COVID. I would look at Twitter and Facebook and Instagram on the 5th of September, and I'm sure we'll see a lot of chatter about the International Day of Charity on the social media platforms.
That's VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir. This is the Voice of America. Guinea's new military leaders are seeking to tighten their grip on power, saying they will replace governors with regional commanders. The junta issued a statement saying that a meeting will take place Monday to discuss the changes and that if local officials refuse to appear, it will be considered an act of rebellion. Israel police say they have launched a massive manhunt in northern Israel and the occupied West Bank after six Palestinian prisoners escaped from a high-security prison facility. Multiple Israeli agencies were erecting roadblocks, conducting patrols, and moving hundreds of other prisoners. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett called the development, quote, a grave incident, unquote, that required maximum effort by the country's forces.
This is Science in a Minute.
Caltech astronomers Constantine Batygin and Mike Brown released a paper in 2016 that suggested evidence of a giant planet traveling in a long elliptical orbit in the far reaches of the solar system. They called it Planet Nine. The evidence was based on the gravitational influence it has on several minor planet-sized objects beyond the orbit of Neptune. In a recent post in the Search for Planet Nine blog, Brown says he and his colleagues, after 5.5 years of searching, finally know where to look for it. The team used data they gathered to create a model that provides new details of the planet. According to a recent analysis, the mass of Planet Nine is between 4.9 to 8.3 times that of Earth, and its average distance to the Sun is 300 to 520 astronomical units. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is appealing to nations to end COVID-19 border restrictions that keep Central American refugees from seeking asylum. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is appealing to nations to end COVID-19 border restrictions that keep Central American refugees from seeking asylum. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. Forced displacement within Central America and Mexico has been soaring over the last 5 years. The United Nations Refugee Agency says factors, including chronic violence and insecurity, climate change, and natural disasters, have forced people to flee their homes in growing numbers. UNHCR spokeswoman Ekaterini Kitidi tells VOA the effects of COVID-19 and hurricanes Eta and Iota, which struck the region with devastating force last year, have triggered further large-scale displacement. In particular, she says these disasters have created great economic hardship for women and children who have lost their source of income and have difficulty obtaining basic services.
And as a result, such people are forcibly displaced, and they are compelled many times to embark to even further dangerous onward journeys where they are exposed to smugglers, traffickers, and to other risks, like, for example, sexual exploitation, abuse, or even murder.
Katidi says a staggering 1 million people from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras have been forced to flee their homes, creating an unprecedented displacement crisis in the region. Due to public health COVID-19 travel restrictions, she says Central American refugees face extreme difficulties in obtaining protections they need in countries of asylum. She says the UNHCR has appealed to the U.S. government to end the Title 42 public health-related asylum restrictions.
In Bamber Beach, we see the ports of entry to the United States remaining closed to most asylum seekers, with exemptions for some categories of population with vulnerabilities. And we have asked for the expulsions that are occurring of these people to stop, and for the right to claim asylum in the United States to be restored.
Katidi says all countries in the region have agreed to share the responsibility to provide protection for those fleeing danger and persecution. She adds discussions are continuing with regional authorities in the hopes they will live up to their agreement. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A fleet of camper vans is now providing emergency quarantine facilities in a remote outback town in Australia, where over 10% of the mostly indigenous population is infected with the coronavirus. A lack of accommodation for COVID-19 patients and their close contacts in Wilcannia, 1,000 kilometers northwest of Sydney, has highlighted a chronic housing problem in many First Nation communities. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Wilcannia has one of the highest rates of COVID-19 transmission in the Australian state of New South Wales. More than 13% of the town of 800 people have contracted the contagious disease. About 60% of the population is indigenous. 30 camper vans will provide temporary accommodation for the close contacts of infected patients. Officials had raised concerns about Aboriginal residents' ability to safely isolate themselves in overcrowded homes from family members who've tested positive for COVID-19. Providing adequate and affordable housing is part of the government's long-term strategy to improve Indigenous health and well-being. But Dr. Jason Agostino, a senior medical advisor to the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that much more needs to be done.
What is happening in Wilcannia and in Western New South Wales is because of a lack of investment in appropriate housing for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people over decades. You know, we saw the swine flu pandemic particularly impact Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people back in 2009. And it is poor housing that is at the heart of rheumatic heart disease across Australia. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have some of the highest rates of rheumatic heart disease in the world, and it's completely unacceptable. And at the heart of that is this poor housing.
Charities have said the Delta variant of COVID-19 has caused a humanitarian crisis in Wilcannia's Aboriginal community. Members already suffer from many chronic illnesses, including diabetes and heart disease. Australian Indigenous leaders have insisted the government's regional response to the pandemic has been ill-prepared and slow. The military has been sent to the region to help, along with fire service volunteers and Australia's Royal Flying Doctor Service. Also, the first shipments of 4 million Pfizer vaccine doses arrived in Sydney Sunday from Britain under a drug exchange deal to boost Australia's inoculation drive. About 38% of eligible Australians are fully vaccinated. More than half of the population remains in lockdown, including residents in Sydney, Melbourne and Canberra, as Delta variant cases continue to increase. Authorities say restrictions will begin to be relaxed gradually when more than 70% of Australians were fully inoculated. Authorities have recorded about 62,000 coronavirus cases and more than 1,000 fatalities in Australia since the pandemic began. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Brazil's World Cup qualifier against Argentina has been suspended amid chaotic scenes after local health officials walked onto the pitch in a bid to remove three players who didn't comply with coronavirus protocols. Play in the match featuring Argentina's Lionel Messi and Brazil's Neymar was stopped in the 7th minute because of the extraordinary interruption. The referee eventually suspended the game after players, football officials and local authorities argued for several minutes. Brazil's health agency said three of Argentina's England-based players should have been quarantined instead of playing in the match. The score was 0-0 at Neoquímica Arena in Sao Paulo. FIFA will have to determine what happens next with the qualifier. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.